the challenge for me not going to high school or going to university was the day that I started business. That was my first business class, right? But I became super interested in it. I loved every moment of it. What could I learn new today that I could put into practice tomorrow?
Welcome to Eating Glass. It's a podcast where in each episode, we ask startup founders the questions no one else will. Our goal? To reveal what it's actually like to start, scale, and exit a company. I'm Joe LeMay, and I bootstrapped my reusable notebook company, Rocketbook, to a $50 million exit.
And I am Will Nitza, founder and CEO at IQBar, a nutrition company I took from zero to 40 plus million in annual revenue. For better or worse, we are your hosts. Eating Glass is sponsored by IQBar, which is my company, so be nice to it. What do we do here? We make IQBar plant protein bars, IQ Mix hydration mixes, and IQ Joe instant mushroom coffees. All of which are special because they are the only thing in their category that centers on nutrients good for your body, protein, electrolytes, things like that, as well as things that are good for your brain, so magnesium or lion's mane to name a few. They are all delicious. Most functional foods and drinks taste like crap. Ours taste good, and taste matters. That is despite them being super low in sugar and super clean label. There's no weird stuff on our labels. And by the way, they're affordable. Functional stuff is usually price gougy, and we are not. I will not be offering a discount code. I will instead ask you a favor. Go to Amazon.com, search for IQBar, IQMix, IQJoe, or some combination of the three. Find a non-sponsored listing, click on it, buy it, wait for it to arrive, and leave a review. And that is the only favor I will ever ask you. Thank you very much. Eating Glass is also sponsored by Ramp. Ramp is a corporate card and spend management software that we at IQBar have used for 5 years now, I think. And I actually reached out to them about sponsoring, not the other way around. I love them for three reasons. Number one, simplicity. Everyone on our team gets a physical and a digital card. Replacing cards, pausing cards, putting limits on cards, insanely easy. Setup takes 10 minutes. Number two, cash back. 1.5% cash back. You don't have to deal with points. If you're messing around with points, you are wasting your time. Just get cash back. Number three, they are better at categorizing spend. So we not only save money on the cashback side, we save time on closing our books because they're just better at classifying. They give us an incredible offer for you guys. $250 free when you sign up for Ramp today. Go to ramp.com/glass. That's ramp.com/glass. Cards are issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply. Final sponsor is Gorgias, G-O-R-G-I-A-S. This is the help desk slash customer service app we use at IQBar. We've used it for years. Similar situation, I reached out to them about sponsoring, and we actually started on Zendesk and moved to Gorgias. Our customer service had forced us to, basically, and I was like, why did you force us to do that? Why is Gorgias so much better? And he said, number one, apps and integrations are just better. We have a customer base on Shopify, Amazon. We want to be able to take phone calls. Like, all of that filters into one dashboard, and it makes his life easier. His user experience is easier. There's less clicking, less typing. Because of all the automations inherent to the Gorgias platform, he just has to do less, click less, have less tabs open. And the final thing is, it's really good for consumer brands. So returns, refunds, things that are centric to a business like mine are made really, really easy via the Gorgias platform. Go to Gorgias.com. Again, that's G-O-R-G-I-A-S. Request a free trial. Mention us, Eating Glass. You will get preferential treatment, and you'll be up and running in 15 days. So we have a gentleman by the name of Mike Fata on this week, which I'm super pumped about. Mike, you're a staple in the food and bev CPG community and know a zillion people. But you're also, you have your fingers in a lot of media sort of entities, newsletter, podcast. You put out a lot of, like I said, LinkedIn content. I think I came across you on LinkedIn. And you just have objectively really impressive outcomes. And so there's so much fluff on social media. And so when you come across someone who is like, no, actually, that's just objectively impressive. You started Manitoba Harvest, which is a hemp company in 98. You grew it to over a 20-year span. You grew it to over $100 million in sales. You exited it twice, and both were nine-figure exits. You've written a book. You've launched a newsletter. You've done a bunch of angel investments. You got a third nine-figure exit with Soul Cuisine that you were the chairman of the board for. And then you know, you live in Winnipeg, you're a father of two, and I'm sure I could rattle off a bunch of other details. What led you to starting Manitoba Harvest? You had a super inspirational health journey that got you there. Why hemp? You mind just recapitulating that the early days for people?
For sure. Yeah. I grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, to a single mom, and we were poor, and it was one of the driving forces that I wanted to drop out of school and start working when I was, never went to high school, and so my mom supported me in that, but I didn't know anything about health, fell prey to fast food, found myself eating way too much fast food, and at 18, weighed 300 pounds, and decided one day that I was going to change my whole lifestyle and do better for myself. And that weight loss journey got me super interested in diet and nutrition, which got me super interested in hemp, from the health properties of hemp seed. And I saw an opportunity there. I thought people were going to start to see hemp in a way of positive nutrition, and didn't know much more than that about business. Just started.
Why hemp? There's so many. I'm fully tracking on the health journey. You found hemp. Hemp's great. A lot of other stuff is great too, right? What were the other variables where you're like, okay, this is cool for, you know, for the health benefits, but also this is a legit business opportunity?
Well, that sounds more like you, Will, than me. I wasn't that smart. Being a high school dropout, I didn't know anything about business. So what I did know is, you know, I enjoyed cannabis, both medicinal marijuana and recreational marijuana, from when I was a teenager. So I always thought that hemp was cool, you know, had a hemp bracelet. But when I started studying nutrition and I read Udo Rasmus's book, Fats That Heal, Fats That Kill, and he was the one that said, like, hey, hemp sits as the king or queen of essential fatty acids. I thought that was the coolest thing. You know, I thought there was an unlock there that just people didn't know about that. And, you know, you put that together, I've always embrace the weird, you know, being a nerdy, overweight kid. I didn't fit in, you know, being probably what people would call a hippie at that time, you know, experimenting with kind of natural and alternative kind of lifestyle. I didn't fit in. And so I thought, yeah, I could carry the torch. I could carry the flag for hemp. And I think people are going to catch up, you know, like it seemed pretty logical, that little piece of smarts that I did have, but it was something that I wanted to get behind.
How did you get to like, okay, hemp is cool, to like, actually, all right, I've got a product on my hands. And now how do you get the word out in that like early stage stuff of just getting a product made and getting your first customer?
I'm a big believer now in repurposing with pride. Some would say like copying. I don't like the word copying because you can always learn and then adapt from there. So I was already into hanging out in health food stores. And so I went on a whole no fat diet part of my journey. So I cut all the fat out of my diet, thought that was a smart thing because some books said like, hey, eat no fat and you lose weight, which is true, but you'll die if you cut all the fat out of your diet. I probably came pretty close being like going down to like 160 pounds in weight. But I learned about, you know, flaxseed oil and evening primrose and barrage, other essential fatty acid oils. And then when I read about hemp seed oil, I thought, well, why don't we just make hemp seed oil and copy, you know, repurpose with pride the other kind of products. So let's kind of market it similar to how flaxseed oil is marketed. You know, thankfully in Manitoba, there's a tremendous amount of support for agriculture, new agriculture products, food development, food manufacturing. So we had a lot of support from the university and from the local food development center on the part of like, how do you make a product, you know, quality number one right out the gates, and labeling and regulatory, all that kind of stuff, because I knew nothing about that. But my in was the health food store that was across the street from my mom's place, because I was hanging out there all the time. And so after creating this first batch of a couple hundred bottles of product, I went there and convinced the owner to sell it, which took more convincing than it should have. It literally was like 2 or 3 weeks going in there 2 or 3 times a week, like, hey, buy the product. No one's asking for hemp. But I was like, it's just like flax. You have it in the fridge there, you know, give it a shot, Marvin. And after literally 3 weeks, he's like, okay, give me 3 bottles, you know? And I went and hand labeled, three bottles and wrote a little invoice for $22.50 and delivered it. And then left there and phoned my buddies that I was going to the gym with and said, go to the Canadian Nutrition Center and buy the hemp seed oil. And 2 days later when I went in, he's like, oh, 2 of the 3 bottles sold. I'll grab another 3 bottles, you know? And it started that way. It was super, super organic and, you know, just guerrilla marketing, I guess.
You, as you mentioned, had a different background than a lot of entrepreneurs. Like, all of those things add up to this question, which is, how did you finance it? Where did you come up with the money?
Yeah, I mean, we started Mentuaris with $10,000, so it wasn't a huge amount of money. There was three co-founders, so we put $3,300 in each. I worked before that. The benefit of dropping out of high school was I didn't have any debt, and I had a little bit of cash, enough cash to invest $3,500 in the business, but more importantly, work for like 12 months or 18 months without pay. So very little money, and Mantle Harvest start was more like the farmer's market kind of approach. You know, we had enough money to do our first run of a couple hundred bottles of hemp oil was our first product. We went and sold that product, took the money, went and did a run of 500 bottles. We wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't for, again, like the government resources, like the Food Development Center that we started at gave us the ability to go in there and rent an oil press, rent a bottling machine, rent a labeling machine for a day, do our run, get out of there. And so we were, you know, the first several months, the first year, I guess, we were like once a month, we were in the food center doing a run. Then it went to once a week. Then it went to, we took over the Food Development Center after like 2.5 years. We leased half of their pilot plant. And then after about 4 years, almost 5 years, when we were doing about $1 million in sales, they asked us to leave and kind of kicked us out. And that's when we built our first mini factory. For most people, I say, like, if you have the approach, the farmer's market style approach, that farmer's market style approach in food has worked for hundreds of years, right? Like little batch, totally. Little bit bigger batch, prove the product market fit, go out there, talk to a bunch of people, learn and iterate each kind of product. But, you know, that's what worked for us. I couldn't see it because we started not only a new company, but a new industry. It couldn't have happened the other way. There was no way that we would have enough volume to do anything different.
Yeah. And the give and take there would be speed, right? So in certain cases, if you think you have to move really, really fast, maybe there's a market opportunity, maybe it's a hot ingredient, whatever, maybe it's keto and you're like perfectly well into keto. Well, okay. If you know, if it's going to take me 5 years to get to like XYZ revenue milestone, well, shit, I gotta move five times faster than that or whatever. Or not, you know, I tend to be a fan of like evergreen, you know, hemp hearts are going to be good forever. Right. So I actually don't think, like, I think the way you did it was awesome, and speed is less important than quality and ramping up the right way.
And I'll just say this, like the challenge for me not going to high school or going to university was the day that I started business. That was my first business class, right? Like, I'm open about it because it's still like in my brain of like, I didn't know how to write a letter. You know, I had to write my first letter. I never took a class on how do you structure a letter, like dear so-and-so, and like write the body of a letter. So day one of the business was business school for me, but I became super interested in it. I loved every moment of it. What could I learn new today that I could put into practice tomorrow? And I think my health journey and my lifestyle changes and bettering myself really prepared me for that. Like it if not, most people wouldn't be stoked about that, you know, because all the obstacles were really against us. And enough people laughed at us, and probably because they were right. You know, they thought there's not a chance in hell this is going to happen. But it did happen.
Now it seems like, I mean, I know it was a while ago, you're like 18, but do you remember back then? It sounds like you went about like 12 months without paying yourself. And, you know, were there times where, you know, things felt pretty desperate?
There was a lot of desperate times over the years. I didn't have a relativity of scale, right? So when we started the business, I thought, oh, $1 million is going to, we need to get to $1 million. And I want to be a millionaire, and $1 million seems like the right scale, right? It took actually about 18, almost 24 months before I started getting paid. And so I, you know, good thing of being 22, 23 years old at that point, I didn't have an expensive lifestyle. Again, I didn't have any debt. I had moved out. I was living on my own in a small apartment, but I basically lived in an apartment just down the street from our office, worked for 14 hours a day and went home and just thought I was, you know, even though we, you know, the first year we did $50,000 in sales, the second year we did $150,000 in sales, the third year we did like $300,000 in sales. Like I saw that as huge progress, because I didn't have the relativity of scale.
In that intervening time, like, what were the keys to you scaling from that 1 million to whatever it was when you first exited? I think it was 50 million in sales.
There's probably three different phases of the business, Will. Like, to get the first $1 million was literally the hardest, you know, because we were creating something out of nothing. It took us 5 years. From year five to year 10, we went from $1 million to $10 million. And I would say that became a little bit more prescribed, right? Because we had stores and we had some products and we expanded distribution and got better at our skills. But the $10 million mark was really our jump off, and a number of things happened. Like, we just became more mainstream. We did a full rebrand. At $10 million, we had enough resources that we went out and spent $250,000 on a full class consumer research marketing project, refaced Manitoba Harvest, the brand that everyone currently sees right now, from the old school brand, which the logo and everything just looked a lot different, and created the sub brand of Hemp Hearts, which was a game changer, right? We used to market the product as shelled hemp seeds, which people didn't know what shelled hemp seeds were. But Hemp Hearts, I could tell you, lots of consumers resonate with that because it sounds cool, it sounds healthy, and it sounds like something you want to be open to. And so the timing of that research and refacing of the whole brand coincided with getting listings at Costco, launching in Walmart, like major retail distribution, and it just clicked from there, and that's, you know, we grew 10 to 50 within 5 years, and found our first exit or partial exit to PE.
So did you basically come up with the term Hemp Hearts, and that became the term for the industry?
I got a chewing glass story for you here. Some other entrepreneur came up with the term Hemp Hearts, and I mentioned earlier, I'm a big believer in repurposing with pride. This one was a little different. This person invented Hemp Hearts, but he wasn't a nice guy. Well known as not a nice entrepreneur. Don't know where he is right now, but well known in the industry as not a nice entrepreneur. Crazy kind of guy. But he created Hemp Hearts, and then he didn't trademark Hemp Hearts. And so Hemp Hearts became what I believed was a general term for shelled hemp seeds. And so what we did is we couldn't trademark the word mark, but we created a logo brand mark, which again you'd see on Manitoba Harvest products, which was a double overlapping heart. And this crazy entrepreneur didn't like that at all, and took us to trademark court. That was my first process. Ran a 2.5 year full trademark trial in Canada and the U.S. Spent $350,000. And ultimately won in the end, that Hemp Hearts were a generic term that everybody could use, so that whole industry benefited from that. But we got our logo brand mark. And my thesis in that, because I was probably smart enough at that point in business, you know, 10 years into business, that I could actually say thesis and know what that means, is we were going to win by distribution, because we were the brand that was well distributed. He was not, and that paid off. So that was, you know, I have some learnings and some deep scars from chewing glass, doing things like 2.5 year court cases and trials. I learned a lot about it. I can explain that one to other entrepreneurs. You don't want to go anywhere near it if you can, because there's a lot of sleepless nights. Because if we would have lost, it would have been a total difference for the business.
For me, the hardest part was probably like the discovery process and getting prepped for that. It just was like, it took so much time and calories, and it was so tedious. I don't know, what was the hardest for you?
Just the unknown, you know, when you're an entrepreneur and you try to stand up a house of cards or stand up your empire, and there's being cannons being fired at the wall, and you don't know, like, okay, if you lose some of these things, like, it's going to be game over, right? So there's been a number of times of literally crying myself to sleep at night, and it was because of that. It was more of the unknown. Like, if tomorrow this doesn't go good. Just after we sold the business the first time, we had a union drive at Manitoba Harvest. And although we had literally at that time the best pay industry-wide benefit package, yoga days, investment savings contributions for the team, like, it couldn't get any better. I was following off of like what Google and some of the other businesses were doing, just making that strong for the team. Didn't matter. There still was a union drive. It wasn't successful. The union drive wasn't successful, thankfully, but the union took us to court, as unions do. And it was another almost 2-year trial and court case around this union drive, including some of the, I'll call them bad seed team members, were picketing in front of the Human Rights Museum on Human Rights Day. And it was kind of nasty because, you know, we didn't deserve it, literally, but those things happen in business, especially if you get to scale in business and people are confused with how money works and all of that, and maybe there's jealousy or whatever involved, and those are really challenging moments as a founder.
Yeah, that's gnarly. That's another classic one. I have never experienced that, will never experience that. I guess the closest semi-analog to that would be COVID, when labor was such a just total shit show.
I joke about it a little bit, but the number one reason I say I'm a recovering entrepreneur and I'm not fit to actually operate a business is because of our 24/7 manufacturing. We had at the end two facilities, but for 10 years we operated our first facility 24/7. It ran 7 days a week. You know, there was a day and evening and a night shift, and operating a night shift 24/7 every day, there's always a super shit sandwich to eat. There's always glass to chew on. I've had team members that and a group, like six people that were working at night, that were all took 2 hours off to watch the soccer game that was playing internationally. We had people that slept on the job and let machineries go dry and like literally caused tens of thousands of dollars of damage, and they're on the camera like sleeping in the back. That night shift and operations in general is painful at scale.
So why exit? Like what were all the factors that rolled into that? And then also, why that particular first semi exit?
And the biggest one is we had investors, and we had venture capital investment that had a somewhat fixed timeline to it. You know, they had made an investment. They had 7 years where they had a sale right in their terms. We were only 5 or 6 years in, but it was the right time to for them to transact and for us to transact. So we got clear on that as a shareholders group and as a board. Okay, now is the right time. As it relates to, you know, sell to strategic and full sale or sell to private equity and part sale, I learned a lot about that through actually being a YPO or Young Presidents organization. And I was just months before that when we started the to look at saying, hey, we're going to run this process. I went to a YPO event, and the presentation was from a they had a cleaning company, but in the food industry. But the entrepreneur, the YPOer, had sold his business 3 times, and said, "Hey, this is how the transaction. We've sold it to private equity, and then 3 years later, we tripled the business because we bought these other businesses, and we sold it to private equity again, and then the third time was to strategic." And I thought, that's the coolest thing, you know. That's like you get a rake and you get liquidity for yourself and the shareholders, but you get to keep going and doing what you're doing. And this thought of it is a true benefit if you have the right PE partner. You know, you become a platform business, and then you go out there and you can acquire other businesses, right? Like, how cool is that? Those are all new things for me. I was like, I know how I can grow this business. We're at the point of 50 million. I saw clarity to get to 100 million or beyond for the business. But that sale to the private equity partner gave me and my family liquidity, gave our other shareholders liquidity, and then gave us a $1 billion private equity sponsor, that partner that we used to go and acquire our largest competitor for $42 million. Like, 6 months after that deal happened. So, and that was part of the value creation to triple the business and prepare us for the $400 million exit.
I'm curious, like, was that pretty similar? Did you sell like a majority or a minority part of it? And then were you still, you know, highly incentivized and had a good amount of equity, but now you had like just bigger targets? Did they inject money into the company at the same time? It sounds like they did if you went and bought your competitors, right? Like, how did that play out?
I don't think there's a right one direction, Joe. Like, it's so circumstantial for the business, is my view now, right? Like, having been through multiple exits and multiple kind of business auctions and deals like that. The benefit was, you know, I got liquidity personally, and our venture capital partner fully left the business. And so the PE did invest majority. And so they had a number of controls. I still had some of my rights as a shareholder and board seat and such, but like having their sponsorship, which hemp was getting more popular, but it was still weird, right? Like, we were a $50 million business. Hemp was still weird in 2015 because it wasn't legal to grow in the US, right? And so having this $1 billion private equity sponsor, we were already towering above our competitors. We just took this monumental leap where everyone was like, oh boy, we better just go start doing something else, you know, because we're going to get beat up here. And then my good buddy, Sean Crew, that, you know, I was friends with for 20 years, we were co-opetition, you know, they were in the hemp food business, but selling mostly ingredients to manufacturers. And we were majority our brand. And I had tried to buy Sean's business. That was the third time. And we were friendly together, golfing together, talking about it all the time. And we said, you know, one day your business is going to sell and then you buy us. And you know, the funny thing is the first time that we went to buy that business, it was $2 million was the price. And we didn't get all the way there. The second time, it was $7 million. And we literally got to, we got to papering the legal agreement, and so we were pretty close, but it didn't work out. What the timing wasn't right. 2 years later, we bought them for $42 million. And so, yeah, having the right partner and sponsor for us, there was pains that I learned because I had a position in the business, but I wasn't in full control because we had sold the majority. But I think, you know, the challenges, you know, the benefits far outweighed the challenges. Including, you know, all the way through to the full exit.
How was life after you partially sold? I mean, suddenly you have a boss, right? I guess you had a board before.
I had a board. I mean, you know, the private equity, you know, it's, we had an owner if they have majority, right? So I had a board before that, and a board's always challenging, as they should be. If you put the right board around you, they're always going to, you know, feel like your brain's kind of stretched after each board meeting, because you're encouraged to grow a little bit more, right? But having an owner that has kind of ultimate say in a number of aspects of the business did add some extra challenges to it. It was exciting for me at first because we literally, like, 2 weeks after we signed the deal, we started diligence on buying our competitor, which 6 months after that we bought them. But all that was really exciting. But I learned, you know, when you sell your business, whether to a private equity or to a strategic, most founders don't make it a full year. You know, most are exited out of their business within a year. Whether they're choosing, the business is choosing, it's just that's what the industry averages are. I made it a little bit longer than that, but it was probably like 16 months or something like that. We brought in a CEO and then retreated to the board and was a silent shareholder or shareholder and board member.
That second chunk, though, was there 10 years between that first transaction and the second one?
No, there was 4 years. We three times the business value. The $132 million deal was in 2015, and then the $419 million deal was in the right at the beginning of 2019.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, like, how did you stay motivated, yada yada? But it sounds like, you know, you made it 16 months. It wasn't that long.
Yeah, I was still involved. I was probably a more involved board member. I'm still a more involved board member now, right? The portfolio companies that I have, I'm not a, hey, I'll see you every quarter kind of board member. I'm involved actively with growing the business. I wasn't in the CEO role. I literally, the day that I left Manitoba Harvest as a CEO, I joined my first portfolio company, made an investment in OHM Mushrooms, and became the interim CEO for 4 months to help the founder clean up the business and take our investment and prepare for significant growth, which then I hired the CEO and became chairman of the board. And so I probably should have took some time in between those, but that, you know, my entrepreneur brain was like, I was used to working, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week and jumped right into it, which, you know, now it's been like 7 years or whatever. I'm glad that I did that because one of my good mentors told me, like, just stay in the game, you know, whatever your new game is, like, keep your head in the game.
Can you share dollar figures or ranges or whatever? I mean, imagine you made whatever, $1 million, couple million bucks the first time, and then made several X that, like, was the second bite much bigger? And did, like, the first one change your life? And then the second one was like, oh shit, now that really changed my life. Like, I don't have to work. I can do whatever I want.
I own about 10% of Manitoba Harvest. So when we sold the first time, I sold a portion of my equity and then got more incentivized equity to stay on. And so it kept around 10%. So The second tranche, the second sale was much bigger than the first. How that changed me, I mean, the first sale process, there was enough capital there for me to say I'm set now for life. For sure, as a poor kid growing up, you know, I had my number and said, hey, if I had that amount of dollars, I'd be set for life. And the second sale really has allowed me to be an investor, you know, and invest in a portfolio of companies. And
what do you focus on in investing? How do you kind of filter on, and what do you look for in either founders or businesses?
My thesis for investment is pretty simple. It starts with products that I enjoy. Like natural products is my lane, not only because I've built success there, but also because it's my personal interest. You know, I'm always looking, how do I better my health? I put a lot of effort and focus in my diet, natural foods, organic. And so that is my lane. And so I look for products that I enjoy in my house that I just love to eat, and then meet founders. And I think that they're cool founders. Like, I'd want to hang out with them and be strategic with them. And they are movers and shakers, you know. From there, you know, the business dynamics, like I could say I'm more bullish on manufacturing because I've built manufacturing operations. And so most of my portfolio is manufacturing. And so it has multiple channels of sale. But also like the stage of the business, right? When I got off at the $100 million revenue mark, I thought going down to that $10 million-ish revenue mark is a great place in a business, you know, especially if you got to the $10 million the right way. Like, you didn't overburden your cap table, or you don't have like a 100 different SKUs, or your distribution's too wide. If you built the first $10 million right, I guarantee you that I can help that founder in that business go from 10 to 50 or 10 to 100, and more so than just cash. Like, how do you build your senior leadership team? You know, how do you scale internationally? How do you build world-class quality? You know, how do you build culture? Like, how do you get past this legal issue that's going to come up when you get sued because you're that size of business? Like, I can offer all those pieces of advice to that size business and scale. So that's how I look at, you know, the kind of company at the stage of company that they're at, and then the value that I can bring.
So are you looking mostly for someone who's around like $10 million, and how are you finding that?
I just hang out at Whole Foods at the salad bar. No, LinkedIn's been great. You know, like I've been in the natural product space for 25 years. So I have a reputation in the industry, but I could say that that's been, there's been a megaphone to that over the last 3 years that I've been on LinkedIn, just sharing my personal growth stories, sharing, you know, some of the things that I've learned, and expanding the community that way. So over the last like 3.5 years, I've had over 1,000 conversations with founders. I love talking to founders, and even if it's for 20, 30 minutes, they tell me what's going on in their business. I'll give them some kind of perspective that I would share of what I learned at that stage of business. And whether they're a startup or $1 million or $10 million or $50 million or selling their company, I feel like I can always provide some kind of value through my own learned experience. And then from there, like the ones that click, you know, like Midday Squares. I met the team at Midday Squares, loved the product, loved the chocolate, brought it home. I was like, this is amazing. You know, on LinkedIn, just going back and forth, because it's easy to do that. I think about LinkedIn as like a 24/7 trade show. So I just take what we do at trade shows and do it online every day. And then there was an opportunity to invest, and I invested. And then there was an opportunity for me to join the team as a growth advisor to the founders, and it was all just very kind of natural. Now that's, you know, 5 years later, that's really snowballing because of the community formed on LinkedIn and how many people. There's so much inbound, right? There's too much inbound for me to handle, and I'm not, you know, I have 9 companies in the portfolio now. I will add more. I'm in diligence with 1 or 2 right now. But I'm not looking to like double my business and how big can I be, and I want to build a team for my family investments and stuff. That's not as important as me living my best day ever, you know, being a good single dad to my kids, being a recovering entrepreneur and not wanting to be burnt out again.
When I look at your portfolio, a lot of those companies are run, they have similarities to Manitoba Harvest, and then they have dissimilarities, right? One might be, they try to move much faster. They're more like a modern day startup where it's like VC injection, 5 to 7 year timeline, et cetera, right? Which kind of contrasts with some of your philosophical ideas.
No, there's no philosophical ideas. And two things. Well, I'm not a fucking dinosaur, okay? I'm in the game. I love playing the game. I'm very competitive. I will go out and outcompete people in the game right now. I think the point there was like, and I get it all the time, trust me, because this happens to a lot of old guys and gals that had a business and they created success. Can they create success again? Are they in the moment? And I've lived my own imposter syndrome going after we left Manitoba Harvest. Can I do this again and create success again? Sure. Created success at Ohm Mushrooms. Did it a different, you know, similar but different. Then joined Soul Cuisine, and Soul Cuisine was on a different ride, but there was similarities that I brought to it, but the business was different. So I like the game of entrepreneurship. I love playing as in the CPG space. And when I'm a advisor, board director, chairman, investor, instead of the actual operator CEO, I can be highly more effective in the strategy. And the strategy is different for every business. So when I say, you know, when I poke fun back at Will of like, I'm not a dinosaur, it's because there isn't one way, you know, and it's not even my philosophy. I can share some things of how I learn and grow, but I can also share things of like how Jake Carls is winning at Midday Squares or Nick or Les, you know, how Margaret's doing it at Nuts for Cheese. And like, I have some influence now in those businesses, but it's those operators, those founders that are doing it their way.
I actually think the way you built Manitoba though, even today, is still the better way, right? Lots changed, but a lot of what's changed is artificial, right? There was that massive boom in VC dollars. Anyone could raise a couple million bucks. Everyone had a time horizon dictated by investors.
Two big things have changed, right? When I started in business, there was no social media. Social media changed everything because it gave you more tools in your toolbox. There was also no online selling, you know? That also changed to the omni-channel approach. And you're right. Like, people went brick and mortar, and then if you missed adding online, like adding Amazon, adding your own website, adding the other resellers, you made a wrong move. And same thing we're seeing recently. If you started as a D2C brand and you didn't move into brick and mortar, sorry, you made the wrong move. People are feeling that now because their business that was worth like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6x in sales, now if you transact, it's going to be like one-time sales as a D2C only brand. And so, you know, and Midday Square started as a D2C only brand and then went quickly into retail. You know, Bloom is another one of my portfolio companies, started as a D2C brand. And then over the last 2 years that I've been involved with Karen, we've transitioned and now she's a full omni-channel business. And like, we are living in the day of omni-channel, you know, like that's how you're going to drive value. But that wasn't around. That's all a new learned skill for me. Like, we built a $10 million business on Amazon and our own website as part of Manitoba Harvest 100 million. You could go at that a number of different ways, right? Like, you can start there or you can expand there. Ultimately, I think you need to be, you know, the more channels of sales you have in, I think about it as like a multi-legged stool. You're less likely to fall over. If you have one leg on your stool, you're probably going to get kicked and fall over a little bit easier.
But also, if you look at like Yasso, Kevin's, True Fruit, blah, 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 these are brick and mortar businesses.
If I look at the number of how many 9-figure exits have there been in the natural product space in the last like decade, you could count them on your hands and toes, significant ones, right? And they all had that, like, they had meaningful brands. And because what's the difference between 2x sales, 3x sales, 4x sales, 5x sales valuations? Product innovation and a moat around your product is one thing, but the biggest one is goodwill in your customer. How much value is it if you're a best-selling product at Walmart or at Kroger or at Costco or at one of these, at Trader Joe's, one of these other major chains, where a buyer can say, there's future value there. How much future value? Well, you could run a model on that, and then that means you're going to get 4x to your revenue instead of 2x, you know? And then those businesses that buy it, sometimes they write the goodwill down a year later, you know? Like, ask what's Manitoba Harvest worth in Tilray's organization 5 years later? You think it's still worth $419 million?
What do you think? They don't have that fat factor.
I think they kind of fucked it up. Well, the founder's only one thing, but timing was part of it. Yeah, I mean, you know, traditional, not to just shit on Tilray because a lot of businesses do it, but traditionally they start treating everybody like a number. Treat all the team members like a number, treat the vendors like a number, treat the customers like a number. And when you take out the relationship and the feeling good juices of a business, you're more likely to just lose control of those numbers, you know? and see it all the time. When the whole team leaves, there's not much that business is going to do. Like, the transition to a new team is going to cost you time and effort and likely revenue and profitability as well.
I got another one that I think we disagree on. I hate active investors. Hate it. I think most entrepreneurs do. I know you have, like, you as on the investor side, you want to be operational. And I think you had a really good blog post that I read on Love Good Fats. And you were saying, I took my first L. Here's why. Here's my postmortem. What I learned was I want to be heavily involved, right? And again, I have like the inverse opinion. Can you just speak to that dynamic?
That's why I wrote the newsletter on my Love Good Fats experience, because if I look at, you know, I had 10 companies in my portfolio, 9 now because we sold Soul Cuisine, but of the 9 companies, I'm involved in half of them as an advisor or as a director or as chairing of the board. And then the other half, I'm not involved. All the ones that I'm involved in are doing phenomenally well. And all the ones I'm not involved in, not so much, and one went bankrupt. So my learning in it, it's not the Mike Fatta effect. Like, I'm not like, oh, hey, I'm involved in the company, it's going to do well. But for, as I think about it as an investor, I'm like, well, if I'm going to invest and I'm not going to be involved in the company, I might as well support brands in the public stock market that I love and I enjoy, which I do as part of my portfolio, but I can get in and out of those brands any day that I want. You make a private investment and you're stuck along for the ride. My worst case scenario is something like Love Good Fats. I'm in, and yeah, it was a nice pref share and the terms were good and everything. But the reality is the business has troubles. It goes bankrupt. And I don't know, well, if I was involved, would that have been the same outcome? Because it drives me crazy, you know?
I guess if you look at it and you're like, actually, if I was involved, I don't know that I'd do things differently.
No, I would have done things differently because I believe what I bring to a lot of businesses is a lot of experience, right? 25 years of experience of chewing a lot of glass. To use your point on, like, I've been through a lot of experiences. I have a lot of scars on my back as it relates to CPG and growing a business in CPG. And so that, even reference to founders, that strategic insight into a boardroom table usually changes the dynamic, you know? And so to answer your other question there, I think, does every founder want, does every founder work well with investors or board members that are highly involved in the business? No, not every one of them is going to. Do I think the smart ones do? Yeah, I think the smart ones learn how to get the most out of their board and their investors, and it not to affect them of how they're going to operate. Because I'm never telling the portfolio companies, unless it's a huge governance thing, like thou shall, you know, I'm saying, oh, here's the experience you're going through. Here's the experience, relative experience that I went through. Here's what the outcome was of it. Here's what I wish I did different. Hopefully that's helpful for you as you take it into your gut and figure out, like, what's the next move for you.
What did kind of go wrong there, and why weren't you more involved? Was the founder not interested in bringing you into it more?
It just never was part of the deal in the first place. Like, I've learned now, when I structure a deal with a business, there's a couple deals structured. There's an investor deal, and then there's usually an advisor or board deal at the same time. So we didn't do that for a number of different reasons. I was doing a lot of things, and I knew some of the institutional investors, and they said, hey, you want to invest alongside on this pref share? And I said, sure. You know, we had just sold Soul Cuisine, and that was a highly successful 9-figure exit. I learn something every single day, and then take my learnings from yesterday and say, how do I make that better for me tomorrow? How am I going to structure things? And that's why, like, people said, hey, it was touching to a lot of people. I got a lot of feedback on the newsletter and LinkedIn newsletter around Love Good Fats. I just wanted to, two things. One, it was a little bit of a cathartic process for me. Two, it really would signal to the world, here's what you can expect from me going forward. So don't approach me if you say, hey, do you want to be a silent investor in our business? It's not going to happen. Zero. You know, the only silent investors I'm in is brands that I use that are publicly traded companies, you know? The situation was, COVID really hurt the business, and then the margin structure and the profitability wasn't achievable, and then they ran out of time from an investor standpoint and went bankrupt, you know, and now, you know, the brand's still ongoing, and thankfully the assets were sold to another business that will do well with it, because they're going to restructure it, but that shit happens in business, especially in the consumer packaged goods business. Fuck.
Every week, and like big bankruptcy, I mean, brands that are doing tens of millions, there's always been the fire sales, right? But what's unique about this era is it's whatever, 18 months since the shoe dropped. That's when people generally start running out of money. That's when people start going bankrupt. It's happening weekly now. We have a series of rapid fire questions that if you have another 10 minutes, I'd love to ping you on.
All right, rapid fire me.
Okay, there's this Peter Thiel quote or question that I really love, which is what important truth do few people agree with you on? In other words, like what's something you just know in your heart of hearts to be true that almost everyone disagrees with you on or conventional wisdom would say is not the case?
That you can follow your passion to success. You know, like people are misunderstood with it or I just don't see a strong enough vision of how they could do something that they enjoy, which that's, you know, being passionate is doing something that you like or something that you love. So a lot of people don't believe that.
And what commonly cited platitudes about what it takes for a startup to win are just plain wrong? Like what is conventional wisdom you see time and time and time again? You're like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard because that does not play out that way in reality.
That you need investors to be successful.
What's the single biggest mistake or regret with regard to your startup journey?
Probably that the co-founders didn't leave the business sooner than they left the business.
Why is that?
They were good startup founders, but after the 5 years or whatever, they added a lot less value to the business and they stayed around for 10 years. And by 10 years, it was very obvious that that they weren't going to make the next stage of growth. And I think it could have happened sooner.
What do you prefer, solo-founded businesses or co-founded businesses?
Solo-founded. Co-founders are like a marriage, you know. If it works really well, it could work, you know. If it doesn't work well, you have a whole nother set of obstacles, emotional instabilities, and things to worry about. It.
I would come down on your side, although Joe had an incredibly synergistic co-founder experience.
Yeah, kind of feel like couldn't have done it without him type of thing. But, you know, I think maybe if you get a founder, if all the variables are the same and you get a business to $10 million, and you do it with one founder, then maybe that's a better filter, right? But I think if you're starting at zero and you don't know where you're going to go, I think I'd rather have two founders.
The question gets deeper for me. If you said you had a founder that was skilled in sales, marketing, ops, and finance, would you rather have the single founder? Or you had two founders, one was a sales and marketing guy or gal, and one was an ops and finance guy or gal. I was like, well, you know, if one doesn't have all the skill set, take two. You know, but if one has all the skill set or the majority of them, take one. It's less complicated.
All right. What was the single hardest decision that you had to make along the way?
Single hardest decision, like we had to restructure and there was a period where we had to go from 24/7 down to 16/5 and lay off 25 of our team after we spent $7.5 million expanding our facility. That was the single hardest decision. I literally cried and broke down in front of a group of 150 people talking to them in the morning.
And knowing what you know now, would you do it all over again?
There's two parts of it for me, really. Like, I wouldn't change anything about my life. I really like that part. But then the logical thing saying, if you had all the information you go now, would you go back? And I'd be like, I can do a lot of other things and be successful with it. So I wouldn't have to choose that.
What did you lose in the process of entrepreneurship? Friends, family, could be anything. And what did you gain?
I mean, I lost a lot of times when I was working that, you know, I missed my birthday party. I missed kids events. There was a lot of things that I missed that I can't take that time. I can't regain that moment, but I've gained ultimate freedom in time and money that I'm using now to hit every one of those go forward moments.
How did you define success pre-startup? And how do you define it today?
Pre-startup, I wanted to be a millionaire, so I thought $1 million was success. Today, it's full freedom and flexibility of my time and for the rest of my life.
What excites you more than anything else now?
I love all that I do, really, the balance of it. But I probably leap out of bed and run towards the things that scare me the most. And right now, the things that scare me the most are definitely, you know, taking the stage and doing public speaking events at larger crowds. I want to get better at it. I've been doing it for a long time, but still scares the hell out of me. And I'm just doing things that are hard that scare me.
Just from a single dad, one single dad to another. How do you do it? You know, you still got huge aspirations. You're still really busy. How do you manage being a great single dad and achieving that aspiration?
I put a lot of focus on being my best self. Which I like the term living my best day ever. So I've been doing that a long time. And now, you know, I was a 50% single dad for 4 years, but over the last 14, 15 months, I've been 100% full-time single dad to a 14 and 12-year-old. It's a lifestyle for me. Business is a lifestyle. Being my healthiest self is a lifestyle, including the kids and making sure that's all balanced. I'm not someone that gives the kids to a nanny and you know goes and does my thing. I need to incorporate it all. And the pain of missing some of the things when my kids were young is very real for me, and so that drives me to not be tired for my kids, to take time out of the middle of the day to go and have a lunch with them or whatever that moment is. And but I think it's the top of that, Joe, is like having capacity to include it all. You know, it's not I'm sacrificing this anymore for that. It's including all the things that are dear to me.
You're rich, right? You just are. You grew up poor. You had a wildly different upbringing than your kids will have to at least some degree. How does that affect how you parent? Like, do you actively try to do things to instill an environment to make them hungry, quote unquote? Do you, like, how do you think about that as it relates to your kids and how you want their mindset to be?
Yeah, I think the biggest learning that I had from my mom, you know, my mom was a great single mom. And so, you know, me being a single dad now full time, I mirror a lot of these lessons. My mom passed away 5 years ago. And so I hold the lessons dear inside of me. Very transparent and open with my kids. I've never treated my kids like kids. My mom didn't treat me and my brother like kids, treated us like people, talked to us, what's important, what's our part in how we're going to live life, doing our laundry, cleaning up after the house, how the budget works, what does the future look like, what are they interested in, follow their passion, you know, and so I do that all with my kids. Yeah, we have a little bit more resources. Yeah, it's a little bit more challenging because we live in a big house and they know there's a little bit of fanciness there. But I don't, my kids aren't getting my legacy. You know, they have to work hard for it, but it starts with the foundation is how do you be your best self? And then show up and like make a big impact in the world, whatever your big impact that you want to make in the world, because I'm not dictating that, they are. And if for people that are listening, like, you know, I do talk about this, but, you know, I'm a servant-based leader, right? When we built Manitoba Harvest, I believe in the upside-down triangle of, like, how do I empower all the people on our team, which there was more than 200 team members, to be their best self, to know which way the business is going, to know what they have to do to skate to the puck where it's going and, like, better themselves. That's really served me well as a parent, because parenting is servant-based leadership. You know, you want to set your kids up for success, and so you need to know what's important to them and teach them these lessons, but you can't rule the iron fist, because that just doesn't work, right? Like, the best way for my kids to be their best self and going after their big goals is watching me be my best self and going after my big goals, and then talking to them openly about that. So we'll see how that goes in like 10 or 15 years. Either they're going to be like, you know, just wonderful people or axe murderers who, you know, that's a big social experiment.
I'm going to be giving you a call on parenting advice in T-minus 5 years. So be on the lookout. Plug what you want, plug whatever you want to plug. How can people find you?
Only two things for me, like all things Mike Fatta or at mikefatta.ca. So you can go on my website if you're interested in my book or podcast or newsletter, any of my free stuff to help entrepreneurs grow. And then connect on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn every day. I love connecting with people. Send me a note saying you listen to this podcast and happy to connect.
Thanks, Mike. That was awesome.
Right on. Yeah. Thanks, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks again for having me.
All right, that's a wrap. Thanks for listening, and thank you to our sponsors, IQ Bar. Go to Amazon.com, search for IQ Bar, buy one, wait for it to arrive, leave a review. Please leave a review. Reviews are massive. Our second sponsor is Ramp. Go to ramp.com/glass. They give you $250 for free when you sign up. It's the best credit card / spend management software there is. Use it for years. Love it. Our third sponsor is Gorgias, GORGIAS.com. It's the best help desk software there is. We use it too. Also love it. Request a demo and mention Eating Glass. They will give you preferential treatment. They'll treat you well. If you like the podcast in general, subscribe, review it, tell a couple friends, tell your mom, and tune in a couple weeks. Talk to you then.